Well, this is quite a passage for one's first sermon at a new church. But I'm deeply, deeply grateful for the opportunity to preach on it. And I do so very much aware that in our midst there will be people who are suffering a great deal. We'll know people in that situation, and there'll be people here who are suffering and perhaps none of us know about it. So I look at this subject very much aware that it's not, as the chap in the video was saying, it's not an academic exercise. It's a topic that we look at, the question of suffering, very much in the context of our relationship with God. The questions of suffering are therefore more relational than philosophical. They're about the nature of God. Why does God allow suffering? About the meaning of suffering. What's the cause of suffering? Where does it come from? Why do some suffer more than others? And the questions about how do we respond to suffering in our own lives or in the lives of those that we love around us? How do we respond to God? How do we respond to those around us when we're suffering? And I loved what the chap said first up. You know, there are no pat answers. We don't answer these questions with a kind of finality. We don't read the book of Job and kind of walk away and say, oh, well, that's okay then, I understand suffering now. No, these are questions that we come back to again and again in our lives. Every time that we encounter suffering, every time we look at the world and we see the suffering that's out there. And as I looked at the book of Job, one's always drawn, isn't one, to the situations that one knows. And a friend of mine, not a really close friend, but someone that I work with at the moment, is a chap called Pete Gregg. Pete is founder of the 24/7 prayer movement. You may have heard of it. It started with a bunch of guys down in Chichester who said, for 1 month, we're going to set aside a room and every moment of that day, 24/7 for a month, we're going to pray. We're going to seek God's face. They thought they could manage a month, but when they saw what happened in that room as they sought God in prayer for a month, 24/7, they kept going. And that movement has now gone on for 10 years. There's prayer rooms going on all over the world. Amazing stories coming back of people coming to Christ, of lives being transformed, people set free, people healed. But the amazing thing is, I don't know if amazing is the right word, the tough thing for Pete has been in the midst of all of that. One night he woke up in the middle of the night and his wife Sammy was having a huge epileptic fit, seizure. They just didn't know what was going on. He rushed her to the hospital. She was taken in for some scans and she was diagnosed. She had a tumor the size of an orange in her brain. And so in the midst of seeing God do the most amazing things, he's been walking with his wife as she battles that potentially fatal disease. She's nearly died on three occasions. She managed to have the tumor removed, which was an amazing answer to prayer in itself. And she's on very serious medication as she deals with that. And he's spoken very honestly about the tension that this brings into the Christian life. As you see God doing the most amazing things, you come to know him more and more. You encounter the God of love, a God who is so powerful, so full of grace, as we were speaking about earlier. And yet, you know, Peter said, heard all these answers to prayer, and yet the one prayer that I want answered more than anything is the prayer that seems to be slow in coming, to see his wife totally healed, totally set free from her suffering. That's the context that we're looking at in the question of Job. And Pete said, I heard him speak a few years ago, and he said there was one occasion that he remembers very well where Sammy was going in for another range of scans and treatment. And he said to her, he said, Sammy, do you ever doubt God? And her response has always really stuck with me. She said, how can I doubt God? When I'm alone in the MRI scanner, God is all that I've got. that's the message that we come to in this passage. That's the response, as we'll see, of Job, that in the face of suffering, he says, how can I doubt God? God is all that I've got. And I think as we begin to look at this book, it's very interesting how it's written. Job chapter 1 puts some things in place that are never to be in question throughout the book, and we need to see why these things are not in question if we're to set off in the right direction at looking at the book as a whole and at the question of suffering. Two things are not in question at the outset of this book, which comes through in this chapter. Firstly, Job is genuine. He's a man who utterly seeks God's heart. Look at verse 1. Right at the beginning of the book, we read this. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. And God knows his heart. God says to Satan in verse 8, Satan is restlessly roaming around to and fro on the earth, we read. Such a picture of life without God, a restlessness, there's so much in those words, isn't there, of kind of the existence of Satan. But God says to him, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. So first up, we need to see that Job is a genuine man. I'm not saying he was sinless. No human being is sinless. But this was a man who was genuine, a seeker after God's heart. The only one who's ever lived without sin is Jesus. But here we read that Job was a genuine man. Secondly, we see in this chapter that God is totally sovereign over all that happens. Satan accuses Job before God. That's what Satan does. He's the accuser. He accuses us before God, and he comes to us and he accuses God before us. He questions God's motive. He says to God, in effect, if you look at verse 9 onwards, he says, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to his face. He's saying, Job doesn't really love you. He just loves what you give him. Take that away and he won't love you anymore. And God knows that this isn't true. We discover by the end of the first chapter already that this is not true. And yet, he allows Satan to inflict the most horrific suffering upon Job. Verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself, do not lay a finger. Now, I need you to hold on to the pressing question of why God allows Satan to do this. I know it's really hard to kind of park that question. It's the one that screams out to us more than any other, and we will come to it. But we need to first see two things in what's going on here if we're to understand things rightly. Firstly, Satan has no power over God. He can only do what God lets him do. God says to Satan, everything he has is in your hands, but on him do not lay a finger. He sets a boundary around what Satan can do. Secondly, we need to see that suffering is not God's idea. It's Satan's idea. and Satan implements it. He comes to God with this idea to strike Job. And when God allows him to do that, he's the one that goes out and implements it. And that's so important because it rules out two of the most prevalent responses to suffering in our world today, and that's moralism and cynicism. Moralism says, if you do good things, God will bless you. You know, we might think, oh, maybe there's a logic in that. Although, of course, that's not the way things work. And the danger is that if we flip that around, if we say God does good things to us when we do good things to him, what happens when we're suffering? Does that mean that we've done something wrong? Does that mean that God is somehow teaching us a lesson? Moralism is the danger of a kind of religious mindset that sort of says you get what you deserve. If you do good, good things will happen. If you're suffering, it's because you've not done the right things. But we know that that's not the case because right at the beginning of this book, it's left us in no doubt that Job is the real deal. He's a genuine man. He's blameless, God says. He shuns evil. He seeks after my heart. So moralism is ruled out, and that's the danger of the religious mindset. But on the other hand, cynicism is ruled out too. There are many people today who look at suffering in the world and say it's proof that either God doesn't exist, or if he does exist, that God's not in control, or worse, that he's ambivalent to the suffering that we face, or that he even desires that we face suffering. And that's why this dialogue with Satan, though troubling, is so important. Because it establishes that God remains utterly sovereign. Satan has no authority before God. And suffering is not God's idea. It does not originate in his heart for us. So I hope we're beginning to see in this first chapter two things that are utterly crucial: that Job is genuine and that God is sovereign. And I know that only heightens the tension of why a good, sovereign God allows suffering to happen to a man who loves him and who seeks after his heart. But the important thing is that we've closed off two horrible blind alleys that can affect, well, we see them in our society all over the place, that those who suffer have somehow brought it upon themselves. That's the Mark was speaking about, the way that many people condemn people who are suffering through HIV. And on the other extreme, a big one we see, I think, particularly in Britain, is that, you know, life's just a bit of a lottery. It's just, you know, you might as well just live for yourself. You might as well just have as much pleasure as you possibly can, because who knows what's around the corner. Society lives in that kind of restless fear of just like, oh, I've just got to do whatever it takes to have fun, because I don't know when bad stuff's going to come along. And the tragedy of both those perspectives, moralism and cynicism, is that they rob us of what we most need in times of suffering, which is to know that God, far from being ambivalent, far from not caring, is present to us in suffering, that he longs to be there with us, and he has made a way for us to know that he's there with us. And this is the God whom Job has come to know over many years. That prologue that begins speaks about a man who's living his whole life in a relationship with God. It's an Old Testament relationship with God. He's doing sacrifices and he's going through that, but it's before Jesus came and showed us that he was the ultimate sacrifice. But this was a man seeking after God's heart in relationship with God, who knew God was a God of love. And when suffering came along, he wasn't prepared to let the horrific events of suffering rob him of that relationship. So let's look at his response in verses 20 and 21. His first and deepest response is to turn to God in his grief and his suffering. Job tore his robe and shaved his head. He then fell to the ground in worship. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." Job doesn't deny his emotions, and as we go on, we'll see that he's anything but passive. He seeks God passionately for the answers to why he's suffering. But what he does do, right from the outset, is he holds on to his one remaining point of reference, and that is who God is, his relationship with God. He's already shown the lie of Satan, who said that in the face of suffering, Job would abandon God. Job worships God not only when times are good, as we see at the beginning of the chapter, but crucially, he worships God when things get really tough. Matt Redman's written a song, we're going to sing it later, based on this chapter. It's an invitation for us to share in the faith of Job. Here are some of the words. He says, "Blessed be your name when the sun is shining down on me, when the world is all as it should be. Blessed be your name." And then the next verse, "Blessed be your name on the road marked with suffering, though there's pain in the offering. Blessed be your name. You give and take away. You give and take away. My heart will choose to say, blessed be your name." It's a choice. It's an act of faith. I remember hearing that song for the first time at one of the happiest moments of my life. I just finished my final exams at uni. The sun was shining. I'd had a lovely day picnic. I'd come into church and we had a worship service and I heard this song. And, you know, I was right there in that first verse. "Blessed be your name when the sun is shining down on me." And then we got to the second verse and I was so challenged. Because I think we all know, don't we, that tough times are going to come. And I was challenged. You know, am I only going to be a worshipper of God when times are good? Or am I going to decide here and now when the sun is shining, that when the sun isn't shining, that I'm going to be a worshipper of God, that I'm going to carry on saying to God, "Blessed be your name"? That's the challenge of suffering. And it's a challenge that we never face on our own. And I want to look in the remainder of this talk at why that response of Job is a gift from God before it's a discipline. As always, we see the greatest challenges in the Christian life, the things that seem to be a discipline, are at their heart matters of grace. We share in the faith of Job, the response of Job and of Sammy and of all those that we see trusting in God in the face of suffering by choosing to start in the right place. This is my first little take-home point. Number one, know where to begin. We can look at this chapter of Job and we can say that the message of it is that no matter what happens, I've got to keep on trusting in God. We can come alongside friends, family, people that we see in the world who are suffering, and we can say to them, the way through your pain is to keep on trusting in God no matter what. And it's true. But if we start there, we're building a house without foundations. Job's response to his suffering is not the beginning of the story. It comes in verse 20, very early on, but the beginning of the story is his walk with God. The beginning of the story is the God who he has come to know. The beginning of the story is not Job's response to God, but God's response to Job. There's so much that Job didn't understand about his suffering, and that's true of all of us. But he knew God. He knew God, and so that is why he did not let God go when everything around him said, this doesn't add up. He didn't let go of the God that he'd come to know over many years, the God of love. That's the foundation of the house, God's response to us. Job's worship of God was not his strategy for coping. It was the reality of his life. And so as we look at suffering, we have to be sure that this is not about something we kind of summon up from within. It has to be the reality of our life, so that when the tough times come, we know what we're building upon. This response of Job to suffering is not what we ought to do or should do. It's not a head knowledge that we somehow force ourselves to put into practice. It's inspired by our heart knowledge. Because when we come to truly know God, we come to know that there is a God who, however bad things get, will never depart from us, whose love can reach us no matter where we are. Those of you that were here last week saw that Michael was looking at the pinnacle of the book of Romans. Paul has talked about the cross and the resurrection, the gift of the Holy Spirit. He's looked at all the implications of the gospel. And he reaches the pinnacle of chapter 8 and he says, "But I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present or the future or any powers, neither height nor depth nor anything in all creation," we're beginning to get the idea, he's just anything, "will be able to separate us from the love of God that's in Jesus Christ our Lord." That's the most important thing that we can ever know about suffering, that it's not a sign of abandonment by God. That's the second take-home point. Know that you are never abandoned. The Bible tells us that suffering is not God's original or final plan for creation. So why does he allow it at all? As we wrestle with that question, we have to look at the cross, to the suffering and death of Jesus Christ. And one sermon cannot do justice to all that we see in the cross, which is why we'll come back to the cross probably in every single talk in this series. But today I want us to see these things about the cross. No price is too great for God if it means that we can enjoy a relationship of love with him in true freedom. I said earlier on how suffering and death are Satan's idea and Satan implements them. Suffering and death are the effects in creation caused by sin. And sin is only possible because God created beings with the freedom to truly love him. And the flip side of that freedom to truly love God is that we can choose not to. And we'll never fully understand the horrible chain reaction of events caused by sin, caused by choosing freedom to turn away from God, the life giver that brought such suffering and death into the world. But when we see the impulse to sin in our own hearts, we know that we're bound up with the problem. That's where the humility of Job comes from. He doesn't sort of claim his righteousness. He recognizes that everything he has is from God, that he's totally dependent upon God for life, and that without God there is no life. And we can look at all these things that happened to Job, which are an example of the suffering that is wrought in a world that's fallen. And we can say, God, surely the cost is too great. We can cry that out to God. Why? Why does it disproportionately affect some more than others? But we need to see that God allows such a huge cost because he himself was prepared to pay the price. On the cross, God in Christ suffered more than we could ever imagine. Jesus cried out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he died in our place. That abandonment that he felt is the sting of death, the separation that sin renders. But Paul can say, as he looks at the cross and the resurrection of Christ, where, O God, where, O death, is your sting? And he's not being triumphalistic at all. He's not undermining the pain and the suffering of death. I mean, how could he, when we see how God, when he was present with us, wept at the grave of Lazarus, when he was moved by compassion at the suffering of others? But what Paul is saying is that because of Jesus, nothing can separate us from the love of God that is in Jesus Christ, no matter what. And although we suffer still, although we groan as we await for our resurrection bodies, God is present to us in our suffering. He will never abandon us. And that is so important to know, because suffering is a lonely experience. We see that in Job. We see how he recognizes that he is alone in this suffering. And just as Satan accuses Job before God, Satan will use suffering to accuse God before us. He'll use suffering to come and say, this means that God has abandoned you. This means that God doesn't love you. And it's a lie. We need to know deep, deep down, as Job knew, that while God allows suffering, he will never allow it to separate us from him. Jesus has gone through that in our place. He has made suffering not a place of isolation, but of communion with God. And so that brings me to the third final take-home point that we see in Job's response. We need to refuse doubt and fear. It's not possible to go through suffering without the temptation to doubt and to be afraid. Jesus himself faced that in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's not a sign of failure to face these emotions. Suffering, by definition, feels out of control. If we could control the situation, we wouldn't let ourselves be in it. Suffering exposes our human vulnerabilities and weaknesses and limitations. Things are going on that overwhelm our ability to cope on our own. And so we have to find a way to trust in what, or rather than who, we cannot see. One night, a house caught fire, and a young boy was forced to flee to the roof. His father stood on the ground below with outstretched arms, crying up to his son, "Jump! I will catch you." He knew that the boy had to jump to save his life. But all the boy could see was flames and smoke and blackness. He couldn't see his father. Understandably, he was afraid to leave the roof. His father kept yelling to him, "Jump! I will catch you." But the boy protested, "Daddy, I cannot see you." His father replied, "But I can see you, and that's all that matters. I can see you, and that's all that matters." That's what we need to know in the fires of suffering. That's what Job knew, that God could see him. He carried on worshipping because he knew that God could hear his worship. He knew that God could see him. God's promise, sealed in history in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, is that he can see us, that he hears our prayers, that he will catch us. He will never let us go. To the human eye, nothing looked in control on Good Friday. It's like that picture that I've just given you of the smoke and the blackness. To the disciples, all they could see was suffering and death. And yet Luke tells us that in the midst of all of this, Jesus said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." He was enduring the separation of sin for us, and yet he carried on trusting in what human beings could not see, in what, because of our sin, he was cut off from. He carried on trusting in the Father. He jumped into the Father's arms. And in that act, He made a way for each one of us to do the same. However falteringly, to trust in God, even when we can't see Him. To trust in what we cannot see. Because Jesus is risen today, no matter what, we can know that we will be caught in the Father's everlasting arms. To use that picture, God the Son is with us on the roof. We don't jump alone. God the Father is waiting with everlasting arms to catch us. God the Spirit is in us, giving us the courage to jump, to be like Job, to keep on worshipping when he was totally disorientated, when he couldn't see the wood for the trees. In times of suffering, we may not see where God is, but what matters is that God can see us. He will never let us go. That's a historical and eternal fact because of Jesus Christ. Peter says in Acts, it was impossible for death to keep its hold upon Jesus. And it's impossible for anything to separate us from the love of God. For those of us who are in Jesus Christ, we need to run into the Father's arms through Jesus Christ. And as we look over the coming weeks at the book of Job, we will see that's exactly what Job does. With his questions, boy, we can ask God questions. That's what we're about, asking questions, seeking to understand more. But we do so with our first response being worship and trust, like Job.